This week I'm joined by Samuel Talcott, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. Having done graduate studies at DePaul University, he now brings the insights of continental thought and critical theory to philosophizing about medicine and the sciences. His research focuses on introducing, interpreting, and extending the French epistemological tradition. He is the author of Georges Canguilhem and the Problem of Error, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2019. And in this episode, we discuss the philosophy of Georges Canguilhem alongside discussions on Alain, Michel Foucault, Bergson, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Omitics Podcast and keep us going indefinitely, please find all the links for that in the description below. It really does mean a lot. And also, if you would like to join the community, there are links there for that also. Enjoy. So, Sam Talcott, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. We are going to be discussing the work of Georges Canguilhem. We just discussed pronunciation. Either way, it seems has been historically sort of noted that it could be, or Georges Canguilhem, King Kong, as you were saying, is noted in Stuart Eldon's book. So, for this, I have used Stuart Eldon's Canguilhem and also your own book, Georges Canguilhem and the Problem of Error, which was published in 2019 by Palgrave Macmillan. Both fantastic texts, and I have dipped, of course, into the original texts. But as we were just discussing as well, Canguilhem is difficult to get a grasp, because he expects a lot from his readers, as you were saying. So, yeah, thanks for coming on. And before we jump in, just tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Okay. Well, thanks, James, for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk about my work and this book with you a bit. So I was educated in continental philosophy at Penn State University and then DePaul University in Chicago. I did some teaching at DePaul University when I was a grad student there, and then a year or two at Seattle University before coming to University of the Sciences, where I teach a wide range of classes. I'm in a humanities department. I'm the philosopher on campus in the humanities department. And I think... you know, I view my work as kind of interdisciplinary, and I think I've really benefited from being in a humanities department. Canguilhem himself says, you know, something along these lines, that, you know, philosophy flourishes when it works with material that is non-philosophical, when it encounters what is foreign to itself. And I think, you know, having colleagues in the humanities has been great for that, and being able to teach some interdisciplinary courses to students who are at a University of the Sciences, which is a very interesting name, but they are almost all the students are oriented towards healthcare professions ultimately, mm-hmm. And so I really see a lot of my work as sort of bringing philosophy to people who are. getting into biomedicine as a profession, and so that means trying to bring sort of broader ethical questions into their view, trying to get them to think about what it means to provide healthcare, and also since it's a university, what it means to be engaged in education. So one of the things that I've noticed. And this connects to my interest in error, is that there is this, how to put it, a rage for getting it right, for having the knowledge that is needed in order to succeed. And so I think, you know, one of the central things that I try to get students in all of my different classes to reflect on is the meaning of error and their fear of error in their lives. So I hope that my sort of scholarly work comes out of and feeds into my work as a teacher.
Okay, okay. So it's almost a Kongiemian approach to teaching, in the sense of something I was just reading this morning, actually, in my research, that understanding that a doctor might understand how to heal, how to cure, but they don't understand on, they aren't taught to understand on that philosophical level how to deal with a patient in that sense. Now, before we jump in with Kongiem, I do have to ask you the hermetics question. So you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick? And of course, with these episodes where we're discussing a specific thinker, they are already there. So Georges Kongiem is already there in the room, and you can place three more in there.
Well, thank you for that impossible question. you know, my first, yeah. So well, my first response is to wonder where I might place this room, and so I imagine a boat in the middle of the ocean or something like this. But no, I mean to try and respond to the question, I think, you know, so I'm fascinated with this French epistemological tradition, Bachelard, Kongiem, Foucault, I see coming out of this as well. And I'm fascinated with it because I think each wants us to think of research and life more broadly as a kind of experimentation. Each encourages an ethics of experimentation. Each also encourages us to think about, to understand thinking or thought as a technique, as something that we do. And in that, they broaden the field as to what might be considered thought. You know, like Foucault says somewhere that he learned more from reading now obscure figures in the history of science than he did from Hegel. Mm-hmm. And so I think I share this penchant, this interest in obscure figures who maybe should be better known. I would consider some more recent authors more recent thinkers who are in one way or another, I think, all sort of responding to or offering variations on the importance of experimentation or error in their own work. So I would look to, I would want to hear what François Delaporte, Foucault's only PhD student, would have to say in conversation with Claire Salomon-Bayet, who was a student of Kongiem's. She wrote on the sort of the importance of institutions and the formation of experimentation as a method in biology. And I would also put in the room or in the cabin of this boat, I would put in the room the poet and philosopher Edouard Glissant, who writes about, you know, the very profoundly and in disturbing ways about the role that dislocation, errancy, and exile, the role these have played, the experience of these have played in shaping a new people through the transatlantic slave trade. And I should say Delaporte as well. I think he's fascinating for our moment. His book Disease and Civilization argues that the cholera epidemic of 1832 in Paris really sort of crystallized the modern experience of social classes and race. And, you know, reading his book, it's really just stunning to find out about or see all of the sort of the political, social political strife that emerged in 1832 in Paris and how it is, you know, mirrored in the sorts of things that are going on in our very moment that we're living in as well.
So if we were to look to that text as sort of prophetic, what came after? Where are we heading into?
Where are we heading into?
Where does that cholera epidemic, you know, what is solidified culturally and politically by the, you know, by that cholera epidemic, I guess, would be there.
Yeah. So I don't know what we're heading into. I mean, I think Delaporte would say we're the danger is we're going to get more of the same. But in his account, sort of an old division between the civilized Europe and barbaric East, India in particular, where the cholera was known to have come from, in his account, that division was sort of mapped onto internal class divisions that were emerging in France at the time. And so poor people became sort of refigured as a class of basically uncivilized or supposedly uncivilized people who needed to be managed. So this way of thinking was then able to be exported to various colonial projects as well. And it's intimately tied up with the invention of public health, the idea that we need public health experts to manage the health of the population, to make sure that the people are healthy enough, since they can't care for themselves, are healthy enough to contribute to society. And also, I think, you know, Delaporte is trying to get at this sort of the potentially disturbing side of our desire to be healthy, and the way in which we can put ourselves into the power of others in this through this desire. So there's a lot going on in his book, I think one of the major fruits of it is he's urging us to sort of reconsider our assumptions about you know, who is who in and you know what's being represented in the the debates or the disagreements that are going on in our society right now.
Okay. So, you know, back to your room, is that where you think the conversation between those people might, you know, head towards is this idea of health? I mean, you've put in Glisson, this poet, and I think that introduces enough for them to not feel that they're in a stifled sort of philosophical conference atmosphere, which I imagine they wouldn't want to be in. They'd want doctors or poets or something else to drag us out of that theoretical sort of stasis towards something with some form of application. So do you think that's where, or do you think it might just turn into some sort of strange philosophical experiment?
I don't know what might come of it. These are all thinkers that are relatively new to me. And so I'm excited I would be excited to hear what they would have to say to each other. So it might be a strange philosophical experiment, but I think, right, my first image was of the boat. Maybe we'll come back to boats later with Kangi Lem. But out in the world somewhere is where this conversation is happening. Glisson writes about the middle passage and the role of this, this passage, the role it played in transforming people who had been dislocated from their homes into slavery. I think they're each interested in questions, larger questions of justice, and health figures into this. But I think, for me at least, the question of the relation between sort of justice and health is a big and an open question. Should we view a just society as a healthy one, or might we hesitate about that? Might we worry some, especially given all of the expert discourse there is about health today? Mm-hmm. Might we worry about saying, well, we have an idea of what a healthy society looks like. That's a just society as well. Mm-hmm. And so we should play that out. So I think it would be a productive and interesting dialogue. I don't know where it would go, but I think that each of these thinkers in his or her own way views error as something positive, in whatever sense we give to that term error. So error can be, you know, a mistaken belief. It can also be trial and error in that sense of an attempt that may work out or may not, where it's not informed by knowledge, but it's an endeavor, a risky one. And in that sense, it also connects to, you know, we can think of experience as always being shadowed by the possibility of error, and experimentation as a kind of systematization of, or a formalization of practices of trial and the error. So I think, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that error can, you know, can be understood in many different ways. And I think each brings something, an important experience of error to the conversation.
Okay. And so this is sort of your reasoning. Well, perhaps you just wanted to write a book, but your reasoning for writing your text is this this importance of error, which of course ties into this entire, in abstract, ties into this entire, many of the ideas we're talking about here, which is in relation to what is considered normal, what is considered pathological. You know, the idea of an abnormality is, of course, in relation to whether or not something's erroneous. And of course, if you see something as an error, that immediately presumes there is some true course of action which we've strayed from. So the investigation into error itself, and not an error constrained, is whether or not the actual entire course of action you're on, how can we consider that to be normal? You know, why is something an error? Am I on somewhat the right lines as to why you crafted this book?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I would just add to what you were saying, you know, the discourse of error is widely spread in our society, and it's a way of dismissing, right? It's error in its sort of strictest sense is, you know, the mistaken belief, but it is applied very widely to dismiss, you know, people say we don't need to take this person seriously, or seriously, you know, we can envision a project of correcting them, changing their behavior in some important way. Or, you know, Kangi Lam, I think it's also important to remember that he wrote his book and on the normal and the pathological. He wrote this in 1943. He finished it in 1943. He'd been working on it for throughout his medical education. But this was the very moment when people around the world were being murdered or experimented on because they were said to be abnormal and to be errors that needed to be, you know, corrected or eliminated and learned from in the process. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, that is those you're absolutely right. I mean, and I would also add, you know, sort of intellectually, like I was interested in Foucault first, and his History of Madness, and that's how I came to Kangi Lam, and found his writing, his book on the normal and the pathological, absolutely perplexing, wanted to learn more. I was also very curious about Foucault said, Kangi Lam is a philosopher of error. And yet when I first started reading his book on the normal and the pathological, it seemed like there was a lot about normality and pathology, but not much about error. And so this led me anyway to take a trip to visit Kangi Lam's archives in Paris, where I found that at two very important points in his life, he had taught courses dedicated to error. One in 42, 43, and the other one in the 1956 year. So this sort of crystallized my interest in trying to understand how error, the problem of error, very broadly speaking, is informing all of Kangi Lam's writing. Or at least that's my interpretation.
Okay. Well, I mean, Just staying with your book, we're going to sort of need to situate Kongiem, I think, soon for those who aren't aware of him. And that's actually one thing I was going to mention to you. I just quickly before we actually started, I try always look and see what other content people are making about thinkers. And there's usually a few videos. There is a lot of French videos on Kongiem, but as far as my research went in, this is going to be the only one in English on YouTube, which I could find at least. So to situate him is going to be tricky, as I imagine you well know. But just staying with your book, you mentioned that the normal and the pathological, this is sort of much like with Foucault, everyone begins at madness and civilization. Everyone begins, it seems, with Kongiem, with the normal and the pathological. That's the one which is the most well-known. But you focus at the beginning of your book, actually, before this, Kongiem has this strange sort of trickstery relationship with power, which he turns back on itself as a way sort of forward. So I was wondering, this bit really interested me in your book. So I was just wondering if you could expand on this, because I think it was an important idea.
I think it's important as well, and it asks us to situate Kongiem a little bit, because he's well, one of the challenges of reading him is that he comments and writes about so many different other authors, and so it's a question of kind of teasing out where Kongiem might be, where he might place himself in relation to the authors that he's reading. I mention this because he presents these ideas of power by systematizing writings by his lycée teacher, Alain, or Émile Chartier, a neo-Kantian social political philosopher and pacifist in the earliest 20th century France, who helped, you know, who was key in the early education of Kongiem, but also figures like Sartre or Merleau-Ponty or Simone Weil. But in any case, these ideas about power, Kongiem presents through Alain's writing, and he systematizes them at a moment in 1958 when the French military is basically topples the government, the existing French Republic, in order to, for the sake of maintaining French possession of Algeria. So Kongiem sort of publishes, sort of organizes and outlines Alain's political writings at this moment, as a way to reflect on the sort of what's going on, or give people some tools to understand what is going on at the moment and resist it where possible. So to give a vision of what a democratic society looks like. And so I think this is fascinating because Alain/Kongiem in this writing, they say, you know, until now, power has taken the form of, sovereign power, right? The power of the king, or the power of oligarchs, a small group that has power. But now we are witnessing something new in democratic societies, namely the emergence of societies of control, mm-hmm. Where power is now something that can be exercised by the people as a means of exercised by the people in order to sort of rein in the natural tendency towards tyranny of those who get power for themselves. And the way in which they'll do this, Alain's vision is, the way in which they'll do this is through surveillance. So Alain has this vision of himself as a philosophical journalist, right? He writes about what's going on. And the idea is that if the public knows about the projects of those who are in control or who empowered in government, or in other ways, like through industry or through professional organizations like doctors, the endeavors of these organizations or people is made public through journalism, then that's a way of keeping them in check, as it were. And so Kangi Lam, you know, he presents Alain's writings. He says, you know, this is essential for us to read now and reflect on, and to put to the test by trying to see how far it applies to our present situation and to what extent it needs to be changed. So I would, just sort of, you know, intellectually, historically speaking, I think I'm looking forward to, when I find time, to sort of thinking about how Foucault's writings about power could be read as a response to, or a kind of an elaboration of, some of the an altered account of power that is based on what we find in this Kangi Lam Alain piece published in 1958, but others too, like Althusser and Interpolation, or Deleuze writes about societies of control, of course, famously. But I think very broadly speaking, this idea of turning a practice or a way of doing things upon themselves, this is something that Kangi Lam learned, I believe, from Alain. Maybe it goes back to Kant and the very notion of what critique is. Mm-hmm. But it is, I think we see it at work in all of Kangi Lam's own writings about the history of medicine or the history of science, like The Normal and the Pathological, constructed in an amazing and very interesting way. But the first half of the book, basically, as I read it, Kangi Lam says, you know, there's this thesis in medicine in the 19th century that there's no real difference between what is normal and pathological, that the pathological is just a modified state of a normal function, normal state. And the authors who said things like this, they thought they were contributing to a profound transformation in their society, developing a society that would be based on scientific knowledge and unlike any society that came before. Mm-hmm. So Kangi Lam identifies a tension there, right? Is that, right, there's this, you know, alteration, the production of something, a radically new way of being. How does that fit with someone who claims that, well, sickness and health, they're basically the same thing, only variations, sickness just being a variation on normal functions. And so he applies this thesis to these various authors who hold it. He applies this thesis about the, you know, the equivalence of pathological and the normal. He applies this to these various authors in order to undermine their claim, mm-hmm. That there is no difference between the normal and the pathological, except a quantitative one. Kangi Lam very, I think, cleverly turns their reasoning against itself in order to show that they misunderstand the importance that alteration, transformation has in our lives, that they themselves contributed to transforming society.
I mean, that does seem almost neo-Kantian to me. I don't like neo sort of anything because it just, it's either Kantian or, but neo-Kantian in that sense of Kant attending to saying basically to Hume, well, you can't attend to the experience of the conditions, you need to attend to the conditions of the experience before you can say anything about it. And it seems to me that what Kangi Lam is doing there is attending to the conditions of the experience which people are writing about, you know, health and the idea of health, the idea of a normal and a pathological. Well, what are the conditions for you to even construct these things? And in the alterations of these things, are the conditions themselves changing? So it does seem Kantian in that sense, but I guess instead of attending to it on a purely metaphysical level, it's in relation to the social and the biological. Would that be somewhat Right.
Yeah, no, I think that's nicely said. I think that's very nicely said. And I would add to what you were saying, right, the neo-Kantian idea, the idea of being a neo-Kantian. I mean, I think the sort of the spirit of Canguilhem's philosophical thought is one of resistance. And so if I were to situate him historically, sort of very broadly speaking, I would say that he tries to put himself at the crossroads of the sciences, philosophy, and culture more broadly in 20th century France. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, that means both sort of being informed by a number of different philosophers, but simultaneously resisting them as well. And so a kind of resistance to Alain's Kantianism, or even to the Kantianism of Kant. So Canguilhem really insists on, he learns a lot from, at first he's very much opposed to Henri Bergson, who he views early on in his life as a vitalist and philosopher of life, which means basically someone who invokes life in order to justify violence and war. So Canguilhem early on is a pacifist, and he is highly critical of people like Bergson. So Bergson supported the Great War, which Canguilhem grew up with during. And so at first he's highly critical of Bergson, but because of events in his own life, I think he comes to think that there are some that Bergson, in wanting to move away from talk about being to talk about becoming, that Bergson is pointing us in a really important direction for understanding our experience and the conditions of our experience. In other words, whereas, you know, Kant can be read as saying the conditions of our experience are basically static. The categories of the understanding are unchanging. I think Canguilhem, while he believes that the conceptual categories through which we experience the world and through which we make sense of our world, while he thinks that they are enduring in profound ways because they're rooted in culture, he also thinks that they are capable of altering over time and can, experience radical shifts and transformation in meaning.
Okay. There's also sort of an irony there in Canguilhem's disagreement with Bergson, that the Bergson-Einstein debate marks the very clear moment that philosophy and science sort of separated paths and no longer wanted too much to do with each other. But one thing, I've got all my questions here, and then last night I was doing some research and I sort of was going through things and I was like, okay, I'll just note this down to perhaps bring it in. And it was to do with the vitalism, because I've had three or four different episodes where the idea of vitalism comes back, and I don't think I've seen academics sort of wince and go back out of their chairs quick enough when they hear that word vitalism, because it's a tricky one for many of the reasons that you've outlined, in that I don't think we all know what we're really talking about, because there is of course, and this is especially difficult with Canguilhem, there is of course the vitalism of Bergson, which is sort of the most, I guess, the most well-known form of vitalism, but there's also the Leibniz philosophy of people such as Ludwig Klages. You could almost perhaps stretch it to someone such as Schopenhauer. I think there's elements of it there, but Canguilhem's vitalism sort of changes, and I'm glad you brought it up and not me. So would you like to expand on how he takes that alteration to build it up as something of his own?
Yeah. So I think it's a big question, in Canguilhem himself. Is he a vitalist or not? If he is, in what sense is he a vitalist? It's a huge question, and maybe he's not entirely settled on this himself. But I think, in his book, Knowledge of Life, He presents different sorts of vitalism. Like, I think he presents animism as a kind of vitalism, belief that there is a soul that brings living things, or that makes living things living, that animates them, as a form of vitalism. But then he also identifies as vitalism the idea, I think he finds it in Bichat, that the living can living things simply can't be reduced to and understood in terms of physics or chemistry. And so in that sense, I mean, I think Kangi Lam would identify with vitalism in that sense, this idea that that there is something unique about living organisms, mm-hmm. We can't understand them simply by deploying the methods of, you know, physics or chemistry. There, and the surest sign of this for Kangi Lam would be that there exists, that biology exists as a scientific discipline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he experiences in his own life, you know, the 20th century is a century of profound transformation in the life sciences, or in biology, biological knowledge, understanding of living organisms. But Kangi Lam himself thinks of the living being as, you know, it cannot be solely understood in terms of the physical sciences, physics and chemistry. And that doesn't mean it can't be understood at all in their terms, but just that it can't solely be understood in their terms. And so he looks at, in this book, Knowledge of Life, he also looks at the way in which, through experimentation, biologists in the 19th and 20th century have come to understand living things in their own, more or less in their own terms. It's an ongoing sort of endeavor. But the concept of milieu, or the concept of reflex motion, or the concept of the biological individual, Kangi Lam thinks that were all produced through long, laborious experimentation, and that they really are true to life in some way. Mm-hmm. And they make biology as a science. They cut it out and make it different from other sciences. It has a kind of autonomy that it gains by this sort of grasp or understanding of life, at least partial, that it has achieved historically. So all that said, Kangi Lam also talks about vitalism in his book on the history of the reflex concept. This is mm-hmm. his dissertation. He wrote it under another philosopher who I think is really important to him, Gaston Bachelard. Mm-hmm. And so I would pick out Alain Bergson and Bachelard as being really important for understanding sort of Kangi Lam's philosophical background. But in this book about the history of the reflex concept, you know, Kangi Lam says his interest in vitalism there is historical. And he says, if we look at it, we know vitalism today is an error. It's mm-hmm. false. But if we look at it, we see that it was incredibly productive in the history of the generation of knowledge about reflex motion in living things. So we can't just excise it and say, do away with it, forget it. We have to understand its productive role in the history of science. And because of this productive role, in a way, you know, contemporary science, even if it wants to be purely mechanistic, is still haunted by this kind of vitalism, which outlines what should be an object of knowledge, these specific qualities that living things have.
Okay. I mean, I'm seeing a couple of sort of clear things there. I mean, firstly, I'm thinking of Michel Serre, who I know was influenced by Bachelard, and this idea of, influenced by Conguiem, and back to that idea of not being able to, you know, there is clearly something unique about being alive in this relation to vitalism, but equally, we still need this biological framework to be able to understand it on the other level. And the influence, I guess, I would see from for Sayre there is this idea of these don't really have to be compatible. Just don't, you know, they're two different forms of communication, and subsuming them all into one is probably going to misunderstand both. So you can do things on one level, but you have to sort of retain it in that context, and you can do things on the vitalist level, but at the same, so sort of, I guess, especially if with what Kongiem is seeing in the 40s, with, as we've said, the idea of abnormal humans, there seems to be a connection there between the idea that utilizing the biological framework to justify something on the level of being is making a big error between two levels of communication. I'm speaking, you know, of thinking of people of justifying some idea of subhuman by something you've learned on a level which is not in that same context. But that actually brings back what we've been speaking about with regard to Bergson. So even though they had this disagreement, Bergson has these ideas of we need specificity, we need contexts. So that, I know I've just thrown a ton on your plate there, but in what sense can we sort of, is that something that it's important for Kongiem, this idea of retaining a specific context? I mean, of course, he has this idea of milieu. Is that his way of explaining why we need to you know, stay within the bounds, so to speak, of certain structures?
Yeah. So I think it's I mean, I think you're posing a really interesting question and making some nice connections between Kongiem and Sayre. I think one of the reasons that reading Kongiem is so difficult is that he is so focused on the texts that he reads, and asks us to think about them in their context. So I think actually Kongiem is a great thinker of place, and context. Mm-hmm. And my take is that, the living things, as Kongiem understands them, need to be understood in relation to their milieu. That life, in some senses, is always a relation between, or works out as a relation between, a particular individual or set of individuals in a milieu. A milieu which is organized for the sake of living, for the sake of that individual's life. Right. So some things get picked out as food, and other things get picked out as excretion. Other things get picked out as, you know, dangerous as a predator. So the life, any activity of living needs to be understood in its milieu. Now, that holds for plants. It also holds for animals. Kongiem thinks that animals have, we might say, more of a world than plants, because they, in his analysis, right, they get up and they move around, they go out in search of they go out in search of food, etc. And human beings, we are a curious sort of animal for Kongiem, because we have, through our technological capabilities, we have the power to vary the meaning of, or to vary the milieu on the spot, as it were. Mm-hmm. Right? Through our practices and our techniques, our instruments, we are capable of transforming, you know, one and the same place into very different things. So what is, you know, what is a, what's a good example? What is a, you know, what is a classroom can all of a sudden become a surgical theater, right? in a particular context, for just one, sort of example. And so this, attention to milieu, I mean, is really important to who we are as human beings. And Kongiem talks about humans as having a world, that is a collection of various different kinds of milieu, or meaningful spaces or places that we enter and exit as we live. So I don't know if I'm responding to your mm-hmm. question entirely, but
yeah, definitely.
But so I think he applies that right to his to the study of the history of science as well. He tries to locate, say these thinkers who said there's no real difference between the normal state and the pathological state. He localizes them in the larger culture in which they lived, an industrial culture that was bent on transforming the world through human industry and technique.
Okay, so the importance of the vitalist aspect is a sort of an outside of that mechanistic framework of pure quantification.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. There's something really interesting to sort of bring in even more to throw even more onto the pile of, you know, it's becoming clearer and clearer why it's all many philosophers, of course, many of their ideas are all tied up together, but with Kongyem this seems they're very tightly woven. You state as nutrition, excretion, reproduction are in a just equilibrium in a healthy individual, so would it be in a healthy society, monarchy, oligarchy, democracy, in a just equilibrium. And was there a clear connection for Kongyem, I mean, it's quite a simple question, I guess, between this notion of biological equilibrium, which goes all the way back to Galen with the idea of the silencing of the organs, that your organs should be balanced, and if they're in silence, then you're healthy. And the idea of a sort of, I guess, a silence of the political organs, of if society is, you know, basically, is there for Kongyem, was there a similarity between the political modes of equilibrium and biological modes of equilibrium?
Yes.
Glad we answered that.
But it's complicated, of course. Yeah. And
damn.
So there is a similarity, and you know the way you were phrasing your question there called to mind, you know, something that Kongyem. So this is a point. This quotation is a point that comes up via Alain, mm-hmm. and Alain's ideas about what a just society would look like. It's or what a decent society would look like anyway. It would be a democracy in which you know, people are able to live their lives. So in that sense, there would be a kind of silence of the larger organisms of, you know, of the larger organs, I should say, of society. Mm-hmm. You know, I think at one point, Alain complains about people who say, but, you know, but life in a democracy is boring and, you know, it's all mediocre, it's banal. And he says something like, yeah, but this is the way it should be. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, this is the best kind of life. This allows for the best kind of life for people. So I think, going back to the question of the complication between the parallel between, vital processes, and social political processes, mm-hmm. So for Kongyem, in a way, society, we could say this, society is a kind of expression of an organic need for coherence. Mm-hmm. So societies organize themselves, give themselves organs in the same way that a living individual, biological individual, is an organized system. But the sort of coherence that can be achieved in society, Kongyem thinks, is in no way matches the kind of tight relation that exists between the organs within the larger whole that they serve in a living thing.
Okay, and this seems clearly then where this importance of error comes in, because if in that framework of equilibrium, if you develop a norm, maybe it might even be able to say an artificial norm, and strive to somehow meet that norm, which is never, of course, possible, then, of course, everything which is adverse to the norm is an error or is incorrect or is wrong, and therefore has to be sculpted and brought back which isn't, that isn't equilibrium. That's like a forced, you know, authoritarian way of developing some sort of controlled normality. Whereas this emphasis of sort of turning error back on itself, of saying, no, error isn't important because it shows you what's wrong. It's important because it shows you what you believe to be wrong, you know, and it shows what we've built as to be the foundation. So error seems to be then the catalyst for a just and, you know, a just equilibrium. It's the thing we should constantly experiment with to be able to develop an actual equilibrium.
Yeah, I think that's right. With the caveat that for Canguilhem, I don't think we can ever achieve this equilibrium. Health and justice, to follow those two separate paths, health and justice are something like ideals, mm-hmm. Against which we sort of measure the difficulties that we currently face. I think you're exactly right to say that attention to error for Canguilhem is essential. And we need to, I think what he would add to what you were saying is that we need to beware of applying the scientific interpretation of error as mistaken belief to other forms of activity or life in the world in which we live. Because when we go beyond those, when we take scientific practice beyond its limits in those ways, we set ourselves up for disaster. Mm-hmm. Rather than error in the scientific sense, Canguilhem would say we should be thinking about, like you were saying, experimentation, trial and error, and we should be encouraging the diverse forms of life, including sickness. We should be finding ways of responding to them that are creative and supportive, rather than treating them as errors to be eliminated.
And this seems to be, I mean, there's been many times throughout our conversation here where I've thought, okay, that's Foucault. But this is obviously the most sort of obvious influence here from Foucault, is that Foucault's, I guess, concern of the potential abuses of power in relation to the creation of a medical or biological norm. And in a sense that people can be controlled via that form of power, in the sense that you feel, I guess, in a certain way, compelled to conform to some sort of sociological norm, which is backed by some biological point, such as, I don't know, depression or anxiety, or the idea that depression isn't a legitimate emotion. It's a fault from what, you know, so it's like, no, you're not allowed to be unhappy. You're meant to be normal and happy. You're wrong, and everything else is completely fine. You know, you should love your 9-to-5 office job, so you have to take these tablets. Whereas, of course, the more healthy discussion is to say, well, let's look at the milieu and develop from that whether or not this entire thing we believe should be making people happy is, you know, which one is actually correct there. So, I mean, I think I'll just ask the bigger question there, though, that there's so much influence with Foucault. I mean, do you think there's some clear areas where there's actually perhaps even disagreement between the two thinkers, or is Foucault sort of always emphasizing or digressing from Canguilhem?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. You know, I'm tempted to use language like critical appropriation, critical extension, critical transformation when I think about these different authors in relation to each other. You know, I think Foucault shares sort of the spirit of Canguilhem's philosophy in some ways, of resistance. And so as profoundly sort of indebted Foucault's own work is to Canguilhem, he's right. And he also shares the method. So he wants to sort of try to turn Canguilhem against himself and see, you know, well, what comes of this? If we read Canguilhem against himself. And so one of the interesting places where this happens is with mental illness, where Canguilhem argues that in somatic illness, right, you know, when my organs make themselves heard, I feel pain. And so I go and I seek help, unless I can somehow tough it out or something like that. But I go and I seek help. Whereas in the case of mental illness, severe mental illness, Kangi Lam says, you know, the person doesn't know that they have a problem. And so we need the psychiatrist to intervene on their behalf to help them. So this is right. This is the, in many ways, this is the topic of the history of madness. Foucault's argument that, well, that, you know, intervening on behalf of someone is often a way of, you know, forcing them, to accept a way of life that they don't want to, or, you know, using, science as an instrument of power, to, encourage them to accept a way of life, that is deeply dissatisfying. So I think there's, there are some, major, critiques that Foucault levels against Kangi Lam. Kangi Lam's response, however, is interesting. He says, you know, when I read Foucault's History of Madness, I realized that I had discovered a great philosopher. And so there's a kind of openness, right, to critique, there, an appreciation of it on Kangi Lam's part. So I sort of trying to think about conceptually, Foucault in relation to Kangi Lam. You know, I would say Kangi Lam really emphasizes biological normativity, and is also very aware of the way social context influences norms, biological norms. So he's fully aware of social normativity. But I think Foucault's big move is to say, no, we need to pay more attention to the social shaping of norms and how those impact our experience as individuals, biological and otherwise.
Do you think maybe the difference there seems to be Nietzsche, in the sense that Foucault has this big influence, of course, from Nietzsche, in the sense that it seems Kangiem is more focused on the equilibrium, that idea we spoke about of this is how things should be, you know, oh, democracy is so boring. And it reminds me of that old Greek saying of, oh, I hope you live in times of change, which people thought, well, that's nice, but it's like, no, they meant that as an insult. It seems maybe that in experimentation for Kangiem is to not live in times of change, to be able to maintain that equilibrium and to develop an understanding of health and justice, which is to maintain the equilibrium. Whereas, and this is why I mentioned Nietzsche, which is the devaluation of all values, that maybe for Foucault, and especially obviously his personal biography as well, in that experimentation, there's actually more potential to really break free of things as opposed to draw them in and have some equilibrium. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if Foucault wanted more change, in a sense of what values can we sort of break here with this method of thinking.
Yeah, so I think the way you put that is really interesting, and I am tempted to both agree and disagree. I think Alain is really for Alain, this question of equilibrium is really important. And Kangi Lam himself lived through turbulent times, lived through interesting times, times of transformation and deep change. And so he was aware of, and I think he thought it was important to be able to face such changes. And I think, right, that, like, whether they're on the, like, broad social level, the political level, or in terms of one's own life, in terms of getting sick, how do we respond to that? And so I think transformation is really important. Alteration, the word that he uses a lot, becoming other, is really important for Kangi Lam. And we need to be aware of the inevitability of becoming other, and be able to respond to this. That said, and so he even at some point says, you know, I'm a Nietzschean without, you know, without the proper paperwork. but that said, I think you're right to say that, you know, in some respects, Foucault is more interested in the possibility of, you know, what might come through some profound alterations of society, whereas Canguilhem recognizes the possibility, the inevitability of alteration, but tries to fashion a way of living that is that has endurance, that can carry on in the face of profound trauma.
Okay, yeah, that's clear. So why is it for Canguilhem? Does he ever really write about? I'm sure he does. Does he ever really comment on why it is science no longer wants to experiment and seeks out these norms?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are maybe a number of different ways to get into this, but I think I would say, sort of in short, the right, the scientific project, the search for truth and for understanding emerges for Canguilhem in experiences of difficulty. Mm-hmm. And the interpretation of things not turning out the way we wanted, the interpretation of failure or difficulty as the result of some error. That's what gets the possibility of a search for truth off the ground. If I, you know, try to make something happen and it doesn't work out, I might be inclined to say, oh, well, if I had only like had a better idea, then I would have been able to do this thing successfully. So technique really nourishes, and the failures of technique or the difficulties of technique really nourishes the scientific project. And it also gives shape to, it gives shape, it characterizes truth, right? If I know the truth, what is that? I have security. I have something I can hold on to that I can use in other situations. And so I think in Canguilhem's mind, truth brings with it this character of stability, if not sort of like eternal unchangingness. Like that's the hope. That's the invention. And so there's going to always be this danger in the production of knowledge that we grasp, you know, we gain some understanding, or we think we gain some understanding, and then we say, ah, this is it. We can hold on to this forever and deploy it in all sorts of different situations. And I think that's the, that's kind of where the straitjacket possibility the emerges, this forgetting of the importance of experimentation. So it's a curious understanding of truth that Canguilhem has. It is a kind of creation of living.
Okay. Why do you think it is he's overlooked? I mean, we've cited probably about 10 different philosophers who he's directly influenced, and they all, you know, it's not a hidden thing either. It's not someone they've shied away from. They've all making it fairly explicit that this is where their big influences come. And, you know, we spoke before we started recording about the fact that there's sort of this Canguilhem rebirth at the moment. So perhaps it's wrong to say he's been ignored, but he seems to have been underappreciated up until now. Do you think there's any reasons for this, or do you think it's just once again one of those cases of just didn't happen to be in the right place at the right time?
Yeah, I mean, I think in his own day, you know, in the French academic context, he was really important in the mid 20th century. Like he was selected to lead a UNESCO inquiry into the teaching of philosophy around the world among member nations. And he was selected to write the lead essay that tried to synthesize and bring everything together. Wow. So he was, I think, a very important philosopher in mid 20th century. And like you were just saying, his influence or importance for many philosophers in the younger, in the 1968 generation, for instance, is really profound. So that said, I think maybe some of his students were more interested in being well known and participating in well-publicized debates than he was. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. But I think it's also important to remember, you know, those who knew him recall his reserve, mm-hmm. as they call it, sort of a philosophical and personal sort of reticence to put himself at the center of conversations that were going on, but also reserve in the sense of, you know, having reservations, not mm-hmm. being willing to assent to what other people are saying. But I think and, you know, this certainly has had an impact on his work. I mean, if you read his The Normal and the Pathological, or his other the works that he published during his lifetime, most of them are on topics that are pretty obscure. You know, the history of the reflex concept. you know, that this is not something that most people are reading about. So he willingly, I think, positioned himself to sort of engage in a investigations into science that he thought were essential for understanding our broader society, modern societies. But he also did so in a way where he was kind of withdrawn from a lot of public discussion. That said, there's this great essay that needs to be translated. Short, he wrote it for a French lycée in Portugal. It's called Experience and Adventure. It's about 3 pages long. And in it, he argues that there is both a need for experience and a need for silence about our experience. So I think we can get some ideas about the sources of his reserve there. But he thought that, and maybe there's another possible connection with Serre here, that we silence about our own experience is essential for being able to continue on in our lives. when we try to share our experience, it's actually not communicable. Mm-hmm. So he ends up, I mean, maybe this is why I often think of the boat at sea when I think of Canguilhem. You know, his image that he deploys in this essay is of the Portuguese explorers, mm-hmm. and their experience going out to sea, and the difficulty they faced in trying to actually convey what happened. You know, the Portuguese national epic, the Lusíadas, talks about the gods and monsters they encountered on this voyage. So there's something about, in Canguilhem's words, authentic experience that is not communicable. And I think that is why he is, has, to some extent, you know, put himself in a position where he, his works wouldn't be center stage.
Okay. That makes sense. Obviously, there is tons more we could speak about, but is there anything key you feel we've missed that you'd like to add in?
No, I mean, I would add only this. You know, my book is really about the first half of his career. The 1960s, these were the 60s that saw the decade that saw molecular biology really take off in France in the early 70s as well. And so there were profound transformations in the life sciences that I think, you know, Canguilhem responded to over the rest of his life. So there's more work that needs to be done on thinking about error here. And the reason I bring it up is that, you know, we can read molecular biology in the 60s and 70s as confirming Canguilhem. Mm-hmm. Because people like François Jacob and others show that, or argued that, we have to understand life in terms of error, that it is you know, errors in the replication of genetic material that leads to mutations, and So this, in a way, is a confirmation of Kangilam's ideas about the central importance of error in our lives. But on the other hand, he experiences it as a profound threat, because it is saying that we now have a scientific objective understanding of these errors. They're no longer potentially a human problem that we have to grapple with in our lives. And so he worries about, you know, the dangers of a genetic medicine and what that might bring. And his response, at least initially, is to say, you know, ask anyone on the street what they think about the possibility of genetic error. And their response will not be one of saying, oh, yeah, right, that's something that the sciences know about. Their response will be, that is profoundly terrifying, to be born in a way that one is sick to begin with. This is profoundly terrifying. And so he really holds on to this, the meaning that error and the fear of error has in our lives.
Okay, okay. Whereabouts can we find your book?
You can find it through Palgrave Macmillan. I have copy here, or I think you can find it via Palgrave Macmillan. You can find it anywhere fine books are sold, is what I would say.
Okay. Yeah. Are you working on anything Kongian based at the moment? Working on a new book, or?
Yes. So the eventual plan is to work on a second volume. Thinking about error in the later Kangilam. I'm also fascinated by, I think, you know, as I was mentioning, Francois Delaporte earlier. So I've been thinking about his book on disease and civilization, writing a paper about that. And I've also been doing some more work on Kangilam and his relation to Bachelard, which is I think, complicated sort of affair. But in brief, I would say this, basically what I've said a little while ago already. You know, Kangilam borrows much from the philosophers he reads, but he's also very resistant. So as much as he borrows from Bachelard, I think he's also engaged in a kind of critique of his idea, in particular, or the reality that Bachelard experienced, that he couldn't write about poetic experience and scientific experience. He couldn't bring these together. I think Kangilam's own writings about the history of life sciences is exactly an attempt to bring together our experiences of creation and our experiences and abilities to know the world around us.
Okay. I would ask you the horrible question, when do you think the second volume be ready? But I'm sure it's a long way off.
Yes, it is. It is a ways off.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it seems like a good place to finish up. So Sam Talcott, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure to be with you here on your show.